No travel was possible across such surfaces, and the only way to observe the process over the majority of the basin was from the air. 1 week in the fall of M-48, Maya decided to join Diana and Rachel and some others taking a trip out to the little settlement on the rise in the center of the basin. This was already called Minus One Island, although it was not yet quite an island, as the Zea Dorsa were not yet covered. But the last of the Zea Dorsa was going to be inundated in a matter of days, and Diana, along with several other hydrologists at the office, thought it would be a good idea to go out and see the historic occasion. Just before they were scheduled to leave, Sax showed up at their apartment by himself. He was on his way from Sabishi down to Vishniac and had dropped in to see Michelle. Maya was glad to think that she would be off soon and so not be around during his stay, which would surely be brief. She still found it unpleasant to be around him, and it was clear that the feeling was mutual. He continued to avoid her eye and did his talking with Michelle and Spencer, never one word for her. Of course, he and Michelle had spent hundreds of hours talking during Sax's rehabilitation, but still it made her furious. Thus, when he heard about her impending trip to Minus One and asked if he could come along, she was very unpleasantly surprised, but Michelle gave her a beseeching glance, quick as a lightning bolt, and Spencer quickly asked if he could come along too, no doubt to keep her from pushing Sax out of the dirigible. And so she agreed, very grumpily. Thus, when they took off a couple of mornings later, they had Stephen Lindholm and George Jackson along with them. Two old men whom Maya didn't bother to explain to the others, seeing that Diana and Rachel and Franz all knew who they were. The youngsters were all a bit more subdued as they climbed the steps into the dirigible's long gondola, which made Maya purse her lips irritably. It was not going to be the same trip it would have been without Sax. The flight from Odessa out to Minus One Island took about 24 hours. The dirigible was smaller than the old arrowhead-shaped behemoths of the early years. This one was a cigar-shaped craft called the Three Diamonds, and the gondola that formed the bag's keel was long and capacious. Though its ultralight props were powerful enough to drive it at some speed and directly into fairly strong winds, it still felt to Maya like a barely controlled drift, the hum of the motors scarcely audible under the whoosh of the west wind. She went to one window and looked down, her back to Sax. The view out the windows was a marvel from the very moment of the first ascent, for Odessa was a handsome banked leaf and tile vision in its tent on the north slope. And after a couple of hours of plowing through the air to the southeast, the basin's ice plain covered the entire visible surface of the world, as if they flew over an Arctic Ocean or an ice world. They sailed at an altitude of some 1,000 meters at about 50 kilometers an hour. Through the afternoon of the first day, the shattered icescape beneath them was everywhere a dirty white, liberally dotted with sky-purple melt pools, occasionally blazing silver as they mirrored the sun. For a while they could see a pattern of spiral polynyas to the west, the long black streaks of open water marking the location of the drowned mohole at low point. At sunset, the ice became a jumble of opaque pinks and oranges and ivories streaked by long black shadows. Then they flew through the night under the stars over a luminous crackled whiteness. Maya slept uneasily on one of the long benches under the windows and woke before dawn, which was another wonder of coloration, the purples of the sky appearing much darker than the pink ice below, an inversion that made everything look surreal. Around mid-morning of that day, they caught sight of land again. Over the horizon floated an oval of Siena Hills rising out of the ice, about 100 kilometers long and 50 wide. This rise was Hellas's equivalent of the central knob found on the floor of medium-sized craters, and it was high enough to remain well above the planned water level, giving the future sea a fairly substantial central island. At this stage, the -1 settlement on the northwest point of the high ground was no more than an array of runways, rocket pads, dirigible masts, and an untidy collection of small buildings. A few under a small station tent, the rest standing isolate and bare like concrete blocks dumped from the sky. No one lived there but a small technical and scientific staff, although visiting aerologists dropped in from time to time. The three diamonds swung around and latched onto one of the poles and was hauled down to the ground. The passengers left the gondola by a jetway and were given a short tour of the airport and residential habitat by the station master. After a forgettable dinner in the dining hall of the habitat, they suited up and took a walk outside, wandering through the scattered utilitarian buildings downhill to what one of the locals said would eventually be the shoreline. They found, when they got there, that no ice was yet visible from this elevation. It was a low, sandy, rubble-strewn plain all the way out to the nearby horizon, some 7 kilometers away. Maya strolled aimlessly behind Diana and Franz, who seemed to be commencing a romance. Beside them walked another native couple who were based at the station, both even younger than Diana, arm in arm, very affectionate. They were both well over 2 meters tall, but not lithe and willowy like most of the young natives. This couple had worked out with weights, bulking up until they had the proportions of Terran weightlifters, despite their great height. They were huge people, and yet still very light on their feet, doing a kind of boulder ballet over the scattered rocks of this empty shore. Maya watched them, marveling again at the new species. Behind her, Sax and Spencer were coming along, and she even said something about it over the old First 100 band. But Spencer only said something about phenotype and genotype, and Sax ignored the remark and took off down the slope of the plain. Spencer went with him, and Maya followed them, moving slowly over all the other new species. There were grass tufts dotting the sand between the rocks of the rubble, also low-flowering plants, weeds, cacti, shrubs, even some very small gnarled trees tucked into the sides of rocks. Sax wandered around, stepping gingerly, crouching down to inspect plants, standing back up with an unfocused look, as if the blood had left his head while he was crouching. Or perhaps this was the look of Sax surprised, something Maya couldn't recall seeing before. She stopped to stare around her. It was, in fact, surprising to discover such profligate life out here where no one had cultivated anything. Or perhaps the scientists stationed at the airport had done it, and the basin was low and warm and humid. The young Martians upslope danced over it all, gracefully avoiding the plants without taking any notice of them. Sax stopped in front of Spencer and tilted his helmet back so that he was staring up into Spencer's faceplate. "These plants will all be drowned," he said querulously, almost as if asking a question. "That's right," Spencer said. Sax briefly glanced toward Maya. His gloved fingers were clenching in agitation. What, was he accusing her of murdering plants now, too? Spencer said, "But the organic matter will help sustain later aquatic life, isn't that right?" Sax merely looked around. As he looked past her, Maya could see he was squinting as if in distress. Then he took off again across the intricate tapestry of plants and rocks. Spencer met Maya's gaze and lifted his gloved hands as if to apologize for the way Sax was ignoring her. Maya turned and walked back upslope. Eventually, the whole group walked up a spiraling ridge above the -1 contour to a knoll just north of the station, where they were high enough to get a view of the ice on the western horizon. The airport lay below them, reminding Maya of Underhill or the Antarctic stations, unplanned, unstructured, with no sense at all of the island town that was sure to come. The youngsters, as they stepped gracefully over the rocks, speculated about what that town would look like. A seaside resort, they were sure, every hectare built up or gardened, with boat harbors in every little indentation of the shoreline, and palm trees, beaches, pavilions. Maya closed her eyes and tried to imagine what the young ones were describing, opened them again to see rock and sand and scrubby little plants. Nothing had come to her mind. Whatever the future brought would be a surprise to her. She could form no image of it. It was a kind of jamais vu pressing at the present. A sudden premonition of death washed over her, and she struggled to shrug it off. No one could imagine the future. A blank there in her mind meant nothing. It was normal. It was only the presence of Sax that was disturbing her, reminding her of things she couldn't afford to think of. No, it was a blessing that the future was blank, a freedom from déjà vu, an extraordinary blessing. Sax trailed behind, looking off at the basin below them. The next day they climbed back in the Three Diamonds and took to the air again and floated southeast until the captain dropped an anchor line just to the west of the Zaya Dorsa. It had been quite a while since Maya had driven out onto them with Diana and her friends, and now the ridges were no more than skinny rock peninsulas extending out into the shattered ice toward -1 and diving under the ice one after the next, all except for the largest one, which was still an unbroken ridge dividing two rough ice masses, the western ice mass clearly about 200 meters lower than the eastern one. This, Diana said, was the final line of land connecting -1 and the basin rim. When this isthmus was overwhelmed, the central rise would be an actual island. The ice mass on the eastern side of the remaining dorsum was at one point very near to the ridge line. The dirigible captain let out more anchor line, and they floated east on the prevailing wind until they were directly over the ridge, where they could see clearly that only meters of rock remained to be overcome. And off to the east was a walking pipeline, a blue hose sliding slowly back and forth on its ski pylons as its nozzle shot water onto the surface. Under the drone of the props, they could hear occasional creaks and moans from below, a muffled boom, a high crack like a gunshot. There was liquid water below the ice, Diana explained, and the weight of new water on top was causing some sections of ice to scrape over barely submerged Dorsa. The captain pointed to the south, and Maya saw a line of icebergs fly into the air as if propelled by explosives, arcing in various directions and falling back onto the ice, breaking into thousands of pieces.
"Maybe we'd better back off a little," the captain said. "It would be better for my reputation if we didn't get shot out of the sky by an iceberg."
The walking pipeline's nozzle was pointing their way, and then with a faint seismic roar, the last complete ridge was overwhelmed. A rush of dark water ran up the rock, and then poured down the western side of the ridge in a waterfall some 100 meters wide. It fell the 200 meters of its descent in a slow, lazy sheet. In the context of the great ice world stretching to the horizon in every direction, it was no more than a trickle, but it kept pouring steadily, the water on the eastern mass now channelized by ice on its sides, the falls booming like thunder, the water on the western side fanning out into 100 streams through the broken ice. And the hair on Maya's neck lifted in fear. Probably a memory of the Marineris flood, she decided, but couldn't say for sure. Slowly the volume of the waterfall decreased, and in less than an hour it had all slowed and then frozen, at least on the surface. Though a sunny fall day, it was 18 degrees below freezing down there, and a line of ragged cumulonimbus clouds was approaching from the west, indicating a cold front. So the waterfall eventually stilled. But left behind was a fresh icefall coating the rock ridge with 1,000 smooth white tubes. So now the ridge had become 2 promontories which didn't quite meet, like all the other ridges of the Zaya Dorsa, all diving into the ice like sets of matching ribs, matching peninsulas. The Hellas Sea was continuous now,
and minus one truly an island. After that, the Circumhellas train trips and the various overflights felt different to Maya as she perceived the interlaced network of glaciers and ice chaoses in the basin to be the new sea itself, rising and filling and sloshing around. And in fact, the liquid sea under the surface ice, near Low Point, was growing much faster in the springs and summers than it was shrinking in the autumns and winters, and strong winds kicked up waves in the Polynyas, which in the summers broke the ice between them, creating regions of brash ice, a floating pack of ice chunks which growled so loudly as they rode the steep little swells that conversation in dirigibles overhead was difficult. And in the year M49, the flow rates from all the tapped aquifers reached their maximums, combining to pump 2,500 cubic meters a day into the sea, an amount that would fill the basin to the minus 1 kilometer contour in about 6 years. To Maya, this did not seem long at all, especially as they could see the progress right there on Odessa's horizon. In winters, the black storms that poured over the mountains would blanket the whole basin floor with startling white snow. In the springs, the snow would melt, but the new edge of the ice sea would be closer than it had been the previous autumn. It was much the same in the northern hemisphere, as news reports and her infrequent trips to Burrows made clear. The great northern dunes of Vastatas Borealis were being rapidly inundated, as the truly enormous aquifers under Vastatas and the North Polar region were being pumped onto the surface by drilling platforms that rose on the ice as the ice accumulated under them. In the northern summers, great rivers were pouring off the melting northern polar cap, cutting channels through the laminate sands and running down to join the ice. And a few months after Minus One had been islanded, news reports showed video of an uncovered stretch of ground in Vastatas disappearing under a dark flood from west and east and north. This apparently created the last link between the lobes of ice, so now there was a world-wrapping sea in the north. Of course, it was patchy still and covered only about half of the land between the 60th and 70th latitudes, but as satellite photos showed, there were already great bays of ice extending south into the deep depressions of Chrysi and Isidus. Submerging the rest of Vastatas would take about 20 more M-years, as the amount of water necessary to fill Vastatas Borealis was much greater than that needed to fill Hellas. But the pumping operation up there was bigger as well, so things were proceeding apace, and all the acts of red sabotage combined could do no more than put a dent in this progress. In fact, progress was accelerating despite increasing acts of sabotage and écotage, because some of the new mining methods being put into use were quite radical and very effective. The news programs showed video of the latest method, which set off big underground thermonuclear explosions very deep under Vastatas. This melted the permafrost over large areas, providing the pumps with more water. On the surface, these explosions were manifested as sudden ice quakes, which reduced the surface ice overhead to a bubbling slurry, the liquid water soon freezing on the surface, but tending to stay liquid underneath. Similar explosions under the northern polar cap were causing floods nearly as vast as the great outbursts of 61. And all that water was pouring downhill into Vastatas. Down at the office in Odessa, they followed all of this with professional interest. A recent assessment of the amount of underground water in the north had encouraged the Vastatas engineers to shoot for a final sea level very near the datum itself, the 0 kilometer contour that had been set back in the days of sky aerology. Diana and other hydrologists in deep waters thought that subsidence of the land in Vastatas, as a result of the mining of aquifers and permafrost, would cause them to end up with a sea level somewhat lower than the datum. But up there, they seemed confident they had factored that in and would reach the mark. Fooling around with various sea levels on an office AI map made it clear what shape the coming ocean was likely to have. In many places, the great escarpment would form its southern shoreline. Sometimes that would mean a gentle slope, in the fretted terrain, archipelagos, in certain regions, dramatic seaside cliffs. Broach craters would provide good harbors. The Elysium Massif would become an island continent, and the remains of the northern polar cap would as well. The land under the cap was the only part of the north well above the 0 kilometer contour. No matter which exact sea level they chose to display on the maps, a big southern arm of the ocean was going to cover Isidus Planitia, which was lower than most of Vastatas. And aquifers in the highlands around Isidus were being pumped down into it as well. So a big bay was going to fill the old plain, and because of that, construction crews were building a long dike in an arc around Burrows. The city was located fairly close to the Great Escarpment, but its elevation was just below the datum. It was therefore going to become a port city every bit as much as Odessa, a port city on a world-wrapping ocean. The dike they were building around Burrows was 200 meters high and 300 meters wide. Maya found the concept of a dike to protect the city disturbing, though it was clear from the aerial shots taken of it that it was another pharaonic monument, tall and massive. It ran in a horseshoe shape, with both its ends up on the slope of the great escarpment, and it was so big that there were plans to build on it, to make it into a fashionable Lido district, containing small boat harbors on its water side. But Maya remembered once standing on a dike in Holland, with the land on one side of her lower than the North Sea on the other side of her. It had been a very disorienting sensation, more unbalancing than weightlessness. And on a more rational level, as news programs from Earth now showed, all dikes there were currently stressed by a very slight rise in sea level caused by global warming initiated 2 centuries before. As little as a meter's rise endangered many of the low-lying areas of Earth, and Mars's northern ocean was supposed to rise in the coming decade by a full kilometer. Who could say whether they would be able to fine-tune its ultimate level so accurately as to make a dike sufficient? Maya's work in Odessa made her worry about such control, though of course they were trying for it themselves in Hellas, and thought they probably had it. They had better, as Odessa's location gave them little margin for error. But the hydrologists also talked about using the canal that had been burned by the aerial lens before its destruction as a runoff into the northern ocean, if such a runoff became necessary. Fine for them, but the northern ocean would have no such recourse. Oh, Diana said, they could always pump any excess up into Argyre Basin. On Earth, riots, arson, and sabotage were becoming daily weapons of the people who had not gotten the treatment, the mortals, as they were called. Springing up around all the great cities were walled towns, fortress suburbs where those who had gotten the treatment could live their entire lives inside, using telelinks, teleoperation, portable generators, even greenhouse food, even air filtration systems. Like tent towns on Mars, in fact. One evening, tired of Michelle and Spencer, Maya went out to eat by herself. Often she was feeling an urge to get off alone. She walked down to a corner cafe on the sidewalk facing the Corniche and sat at one of its outdoor tables under trees strung with lights and ordered antipasto and spaghetti, and ate abstractedly while she drank a small carafe of Chianti and listened to a small band of musicians play. The leader played a kind of accordion with nothing but buttons on it called a bandoneon, and his companions played violin, guitar, piano, and an upright bass. A bunch of wizened old men, guys her age, rollicking their way with a tight, nimble attack through gaily melancholy tunes, gypsy songs, tangos, odd scraps they seemed to be improvising together. When her meal ended, she sat for a long time listening to them, nursing a last glass of wine and then a coffee, watching the other diners, the leaves overhead, the distant ice scape beyond the Cornish, the clouds tumbling in over the Hellespontus. Trying to think as little as possible. For a while it worked, and she made a blissful escape into some older Odessa, some Europe of the mind, as sweet and sad as the duets of violin and accordion. But then the people at the next table began to debate what percentage of Earth's population had received the treatment. One argued 10%, another 40%. A sign of the information war, or simply the level of chaos that obtained there. Then, as she turned away from them, she noticed a headline on the newspaper screen placed over the bar, and read the sentences scrolling right to left after it. The World Court had suspended operations in order to move from The Hague to Bern, and Consolidated had seized the opportunity of the break to attempt a hostile takeover of Praxis Holdings in Kashmir, which in effect meant starting a large coup or small war against the government of Kashmir from Consolidated's base in Pakistan, which would of course draw India into it. And India had been dealing with Praxis lately as well. India versus Pakistan, Praxis versus Consolidated. Most of the world's population, untreated and desperate. That night, when Maya went home, Michelle said that this assault marked a new level of respect for the World Court in that Consolidated had timed its move to the court's recess. But given the devastation in Kashmir and the reversal for Praxis, Maya was in no mood to listen to him. Michelle was so stubbornly optimistic that it made him stupid sometimes, or at least painful to be around. One had to admit it. They lived in a darkening situation. The cycle of madness on Earth was coming around again, caught in its inexorable sine wave, a sine wave more awful than even Maya's, and soon they would be back in the midst of one of those paroxysms, out of control, struggling to avoid obliteration. She could feel it. They were falling back in. She began eating in the corner cafe regularly to hear the band and be alone. She sat with her back to the bar, but it was impossible not to think about things. Earth, their curse, their original sin. She tried to understand. She tried to see it as Frank would have seen it. Tried to hear his voice analyzing it. The group of 11... the old G7 plus Korea, Azania, Mexico, and Russia were still in titular command of much of Terra's power, in the form of their militaries and their capital. The only real competitors to those old dinosaurs were the big metanationals which had coalesced like Athena's out of the transnats. The big metanats, and there was only room in the two-world economy for about a dozen of them, by definition, were of course interested in taking over countries in the group of 11, as they had so many smaller countries. The metanats that succeeded in this effort would probably win the dominance game among themselves, and so some of them were trying to divide and conquer the G11, doing their best to pit the 11 against each other, or to bribe some to break ranks. All the while competing among themselves, so that while some had allied themselves with G11 countries in an attempt to subsume them, others had concentrated on poor countries, or the baby tigers, to build up their strength. So there was a kind of complex balance of power, the strongest old nations against the biggest new metanationals, with the Islamic League, India, China, and the smaller metanats existing as independent loci of power, forces that couldn't be predicted. Thus the balance of power, like any moment of temporary equipoise, was fragile, necessarily so, as half the population of the Earth lived in India and China, a fact Maya could never quite believe or comprehend. History was so strange, and there was no knowing what side of the balance this half of humanity might come down on. And of course, all this begged the question of why there was so much conflict to begin with. Why, Frank? She thought as she sat listening to the cutting melancholy tangos. What is the motivation of these metanational rulers?
But she could see his cynical grin, the one from the years when she had known him. Empires have long half-lives, as he had remarked to her once. And the idea of empire has the longest half-life of all, so that there were people around still trying to be Genghis Khan, to rule the world no matter the cost. Executives in the Medinats, leaders in the Group of 11, generals in the armies. Or, suggested her mental Frank, calmly, brutally, Earth had a carrying capacity. People had overshot it. Many of them would therefore die. Everyone knew this. The fight for resources was correspondingly fierce. The fighters, perfectly rational, but desperate. The musicians played on, their tart nostalgia made even more poignant as the months passed and the long winter came on, and they played through the snowy dusks with the whole world darkening, entre chien et loup. Something so small and brave in that bandonian wheeze, in those little tunes pattering on in the face of it all. Normal life clung to so stubbornly in a patch of light under bare-branched trees. So familiar, this apprehension. This was how it had felt in the years before 61. Even though she couldn't remember any of the individual incidents and crises that had constituted the pre-war period last time around, she could still remember the feel of it as fully as if stimulated by a familiar scent. How nothing seemed to matter. How even the best days were pale and chill under the black clouds that lay massed to the west. How the pleasures of town life took on an antic, desperate edge. Everyone with their backs to the bar, so to speak, doing their best to counteract a feeling of diminution, of helplessness. Oh yes, this was deja vu, all right. So when they traveled around Hellas and met with Free Mars groups, Maya was thankful to see the people who came, who made the effort to believe that their actions could make a difference even in the face of the great vortex swirling below them. Maya learned from them that everywhere he went, Nergal was apparently insisting to the other natives that the situation on Earth was critical to their own fortunes, no matter how distant it seemed. And this was having an effect. Now the people who came to the meetings were full of the news of Consolidated and Amex and Subarashi, and of the recent new incursions into the southern highlands by the UNTA police, incursions which had forced the abandonment of overhangs and many hidden sanctuaries. The south was being emptied, all the hidden ones flooding into Hiranyagarbha or Sabishi or Odessa and the East Hellas Canyons. Some of the young natives Maya met seemed to think that the UNTA appropriation of the South was basically a good thing as it began the countdown to action. She was quick to denounce such thinking. "It's not them who should have control of the timetable," she told them. "We have to control the timing of this. We have to wait for our moment and then all act together. If you don't see that..." "Then you're fools." But Frank had always lashed out at his audiences. These people needed something more, or, to be precise, they deserved something more, something positive, something to draw them as well as to drive them. Frank had said this too, but he had seldom acted on it. They needed to be seduced, like the nightly dancers on the Cornish. Probably these people were out on their own waterfronts on all the other nights of the week, and politics needed to co-opt some of that erotic energy, or else it was only a matter of ressentiment and damage control. So she seduced them. She did it even when she was worried or frightened or in a bad mood. She stood among them thinking about sex with the tall, lithe young men, and then she sat down in their midst and asked them questions.
She caught their gazes one by one, all of them so tall that when she sat on tables, she was eye to eye with them as they sat in chairs, and she engaged them in conversation as intimate and pleasurable as she could make it. What did they want from life, from Mars? Often she laughed out loud at their responses, caught unawares by their innocence or their wit. They had themselves already dreamed Marses more radical than any she could believe in, Marses that were truly independent, egalitarian, just, and joyous. And in some ways they had already enacted these dreams. Many of them now had made their little warrens into extensive communal apartments, and they worked in their alternative economy that had less and less connection with the Transitional Authority or the Metanats. An economy governed by Marina's eco-economics and Hiroko's areophany, by the Sufis and by Nergal, by his roving gypsy government of the young. They felt they were going to live forever. They felt they lived in a world of sensuous beauty. Their confinement in tents was normality, but a stage only. A confinement in warm womb mesocosms, which would be inevitably followed by their emergence onto a free living surface. By their birth, yes. They were embryo areurges, to use Michelle's term. Young gods operating their world, people who knew they were meant to be free and were confident they would get there, and soon. Bad news would come from Earth, and attendance at the meetings would rise, and in these meetings the air wasn't one of fear, but of determination, of the look on Frank's face in the photo over her sink. A struggle between ex-allies Armscor and Subarashi over Nigeria resulted in the use of biological weapons, both sides disclaimed responsibility, so that the people, animals, and plants of Lagos and the surrounding area were devastated by grotesque diseases. And in the meetings that month, the young Martians spoke angrily, their eyes flashing, of the lack of any rule of law on Earth, the lack of any authority that could be trusted. The metanational global order was too dangerous to be allowed to rule Mars. Maya let them talk for an hour before she said anything but "I know," and she did know. It almost made her weep to look at them, to see how shocked they were by injustice and cruelty. Then she went over the points of the Dorsa Brevia Declaration one by one, describing how each had been argued out, what it meant, and what its implementation in the real world would feel like in their lives. They knew more about this than she did, and these parts of the discussion got them more fired up than any complaints about Earth, less anxious and more enthusiastic. And in trying to envision a future based on the Declaration, she often got them laughing. Ludicrous scenarios of collective harmony, everyone at peace and happy. They knew the squabbling, cramped reality of their shared apartments, and so it really was funny. The light in the eyes of laughing young Martians. Even she, who never laughed, felt a small smile rearranging the unseen map of wrinkles that was her face. And so she would end the meeting, feeling that it was work well done. What use was utopia without joy, after all? What was the point of all their striving if it didn't include the laughter of the young? This was what Frank had never understood, at least not in his latter years. And so she would abandon Spencer's security procedures and lead the people in the meetings out of their rooms and down to the dry waterfronts or into parks and cafes to have a walk or a drink or a late meal, feeling that she had found one of the keys to revolution. A key that Frank had never known existed, but only suspected when looking at John. "Of course," Michelle said when she returned to Odessa and tried to tell him about it. But Frank was not a believer in revolution anyway. He was a diplomat, a cynic, a counter-revolutionary. Joy was not in his nature. It was all damage control to him. But Michelle was often contrary with her these days. He had learned to explode rather than to soothe if she showed signs she needed a fight. and she appreciated that so much that she found she didn't need to fight nearly so often. "Come on," she objected at this characterization of Frank, and shoved Michelle onto their bed and ravished him, just for the fun of it, just to drag him into the realm of joy and make him admit it. She knew perfectly well that he felt it was his duty to pull her always back toward the midline of her mood oscillations, and she could see his point, no one more so, and appreciated the anchoring he tried to provide. But sometimes, soaring up at the top of the curve, she saw no reason not to enjoy it a little, those brief moments of no-G flight, something like a spiritual status orgasmus. And so she would pull him up by the cock to that level, and make him smile for an hour or two. Then it was possible for them to walk together downstairs and out the gate, and down through the park, over to her café in a mood of relaxation and peace, there to sit with their backs to the bar and listen to the flamenco guitarist or the old tango band playing its piazzolas, talking casually about the work around the basin, or not talking at all.
This ends side 2 of cassette 16 of Green Mars. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 17.